You're listening to Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. You can talk to us about anything you hear on the show or elsewhere. We're on Twitter at MarketplaceWKND. Now, come with me for a moment to an imaginary place where the U.S. government shuts down, like on this episode of The West Wing.
There is no next, sir. I mean, not to get too technical, but this government runs out of money at midnight, and my guys have gone home. This is it.
Or where the highest court in the country operates a little on the short side, like on Designated Survivor.
Rather than delay the wheels of justice any longer debating the merits of a potential Chief Justice, we propose to proceed with the 8 already considered and approved.
Okay, you probably get where I'm going with this. These fictional scenarios are not far off from our political reality. And here's the thing. You heard me mention our poll earlier in the show. We found that 74% of you, regardless of political party, think Washington has forgotten about people like you. Let that sink in for a second. You're saying that government isn't working, that something is broken. So what does that mean for all of us? We took that idea and ran with it in all three branches of government. We're going to start with former Republican Congressman Tom Davis, who's here to tell us what Congress's job is, or should be.
Congress's job is what it's always been. It's been to pass laws. The one thing they have to do, of course, is pass appropriations. It's becoming more and more difficult to get things through Congress because it's just a very highly polarized environment. It's not just this Congress. This has been going on for many years. The last time Congress passed all of the appropriation bills in a timely manner was in 1996 for fiscal year 1997. And we only did it that year because it was politically expedient to do it. We'd shut the government down twice the year before and we were kind of doing atonement. I think if you left it to the appropriators, they could get the thing done really quick. So writing the appropriations for the year, it's not easy. It's controversial, but it's very doable. It's the fact that since this is probably the only thing that moves through Congress, you get a lot of attachments on this of what we call riders, policy riders, where you attach a lot of other laws to the appropriation bill as it goes through. And that's where the controversy comes in. And we're seeing it this year, funding for the wall, Democrats wanting to say, well, we want funding for Obamacare, we won't deliver the votes. And the complication of this is that the House can pass these bills and routinely gets these bills out in relatively early, at least most of the bills. But in the Senate, you still need 60 votes to pass an appropriation bill. It's the only leverage Democrats have for their policies is to say to the Republicans, you can't attach policy riders and we have our own spending priorities. And there's also a feeling that if you wait until the end, the pressure builds on the other side to cut a deal. It doesn't always bear out. It's hard to say who started this. It tends to get, a little worse each Congress in terms of upping the ante. But once rules and precedents don't have a role or there's no honoring of them, there's no boundaries, it becomes the Wild West. And majorities do whatever they can get away with. You'll find often that with each Congress in the House, the rules are changed because it only takes a majority in the House to change the rules. And they're constantly changed in the House, depending on who's in the majority and how it advantages them and public opinion. But in the Senate, because it's a continuing body, members serve 6-year terms, not 2-year terms. It takes a supermajority to change the rules. That's very difficult. So what you find are rulings from the chair that break all precedent but get sustained by a majority. And the end result is you start breaking one rule, it's easy to break the next rule. And it's kind of like the end justifies the means.
If there is one branch of government that is meant to play by the rules, it's the courts, judges, the judiciary. Here's Jessica Levinson, a professor at Loyola Law School, to tell us what happens when they don't. For example, having 8 Supreme Court justices for almost a year, not 9.
In terms of the person who is sitting in the car and listening and saying, well, how does it really affect my daily life that the Supreme Court wasn't operating at full capacity? Well, they didn't take or didn't make decisions on some of the quote-unquote bigger issues. So they didn't make a big decision based on how public sector unions are funded, on affirmative action, on certain immigration policies, on some issues of religious freedom. And so for people who are affected by those decisions or care deeply about them, then they're living with the lower court decisions. This is an existential question that I think it feeds into a huge problem with why people feel so removed from our government, which is it's very difficult for people to feel deeply in their daily lives the effect of the Supreme Court, even though, frankly, it does have a huge effect on almost every area. I mean, they make decisions that really dictate the type of government and the type of democracy that we live in. The Supreme Court has made a number of decisions that we feel very deeply in the sense of reproductive health, civil rights, the right to vote, in criminal justice, the right to have an attorney. But it's also important to remember that most of the decisions that the Supreme Court makes aren't the decisions that are going to be splashed across the front page of a newspaper. They're decisions that deal with kind of an arcane provision of the tax code or how to interpret the bankruptcy statute. We need the Supreme Court to do all of those things. We need the Supreme Court to help interpret the Constitution, and we need the Supreme Court to help solve circuit splits where some circuit in the country says, yes, this is permissible. Another circuit says, no, it isn't. We need the Supreme Court to help us know what the law of the federal land is.
The executive branch is often modeled around the person at the top, the president. And that can mean broadening executive power. So how does that affect you? We asked Kate Shaw, a professor at Cardozo School of Law. She worked for President Obama in the White House.
The presidency is a funny institution in lots of ways. Much of what the president does is rhetorical, right? Or it's expressive. It very rarely happens that the president takes a step that the next day sort of reverberates in people's daily lives, right? The Supreme Court declares marriage equality the law of the land. People start getting married. Congress passes health care. People start enrolling in health care. You know, it takes a little while to ramp some of this stuff up, but it happens pretty quickly. With the president, that's less often the case. So he can issue an executive order, say, that says build a wall, right, between the United States and Mexico. And a wall doesn't spring up, right? So there are a lot of things that have to happen before those directives actually become reality, if in fact they ever do. It's also the case that the president really only acts, especially if we're talking about executive orders, when he has some existing legal authority to do so. So there's got to be a statute that gives him some kind of power, or the Constitution itself that gives him some kind of power. So even with the wall, there's a statute that he's basically interpreting. So he has to call the Department of Homeland Security and ask them to figure out if there's a way to build this wall. So DHS has to figure out if there's a way to do that. There may or may not be. The courts have to figure out if it's in fact lawful. Congress has to appropriate money to do it. So a lot of things have to happen before presidential directives actually impact people's lives. Certainly when you have an era of congressional gridlock, which is not brand new, but it's certainly new kind of in a broad historical context, the power of the presidency, I think, rises accordingly. One of the things that the vision of the presidency that the founders had was that the president could act sort of with energy and dispatch, right? So this is this famous phrase. So the president is sort of nimble, and there is concentrated power in the presidency. The president can move quickly, doesn't need to necessarily broker compromises the way, you know, members of Congress have to do. But there are still constitutional limits on what the president can do. And in fact, much presidential power really is rhetorical. So if the president wants to get something done, much of the time historically, his time is best spent trying to kind of galvanize public opinion that then gets directed at Congress to actually take steps. So it is this kind of amorphous and, again, largely rhetorical power. I do think that there is kind of a one-way ratchet quality to presidential power. When presidents assert power and that power goes, those assertions go unchallenged, the next president is obviously going to claim the same broad power. It is the case that there's this kind of sort of destructive or disruptive quality to sort of every new presidency sort of does a lot of dismantling of what came before, right? So presidents in some way sort of define themselves, especially, of course, if you have a change in party. You have presidents sort of defining themselves in opposition to what came before, but one thing that they are generally aligned on is exercising the broadest possible power.
So what bothers you the most when government just doesn't work the way it should? Share your thoughts via email. We're weekend@marketplace.org, or follow us on Twitter. We're @marketplace WKND.